Tyler Foley, thanks for being on the podcast, man. How's it going?
Oh, it's pretty good, Shane. I'm looking forward to getting underground and getting into whatever antics we get into.
Hell yeah, man. It's going to be a good episode today. You're a very interesting person. You're a professional storyteller. You help people, you know, find their voice. You do motivational speaking. You're a coach, an author, your book. I mean, you know, very interesting, cool stuff, man. And so, yeah, we're gonna have a fun time today.
My hope and my belief anyways.
Yeah. So maybe let's just start off. Like, how did you get into this area?
Basically, everything in my life has pushed me towards it. At a very early age, 6 years old, I started on stage and then slowly got into film and television. By the time I was in my late teens, I was doing film and TV full-time as a profession and a career. Gradually got into a little bit of stunt work. So I'm not a stuntman by any stretch of the imagination or a professional affiliation, because there are stunt unions. But I was lucky enough to be able to do some stunt work at an early age and get to dabble in it with some really, really well-qualified and unbelievably talented stunt professionals. And then moved away from film and television after 20 years. You know, when you're 20 years into a career, you're allowed to retire. So sure. At 25, I stepped away from performance for a bit, went back to school, got an engineering discipline from a wonderful polytechnic school.
Nice.
And then started my own business. That business unfortunately collapsed, but it was in the geomatics field, which is map making and surveying. And when you're in that particular field, your primary client is the government. The government always insists that you have a safety system in place. And so I had taken all the safety training, and a friend of mine, who is a far better businessman than I am, had said, listen, my company's thriving and expanding, and I need a safety manager, and you have all the safety training from the work that you were doing with the government. If you get these two other courses, you can actually get a designation as a National Construction Safety Officer, and then you could come work with me on this big project that I have. Would you be interested? And I said, why not? I'm not doing anything right now, and money sounds good.
Yeah.
So he paid for my courses. I ended up going up and working for him, and it was a large, he had a multi-million dollar contract on a multi-billion dollar build. And so there was a lot of very high-priced executives that would come through the site and check things out. And there were large interdepartmental group safety meetings, multiple trades involved.
Cool.
And this one day, I was angry with the guys because they weren't listening, and we had some very, very important people on site, right? Mm-hmm. I don't always wear my PPE, but when I do, somebody important is on site. Well, these guys were not doing the things that they should be. And I went off, and they're like, well, you don't know, and they're right. I've never really been a good tradesman. I've dabbled in working with concrete, electrical, and plumbing. And when I say dabble, I mean I've messed around with stuff in my own house. I'm not a tradesman by any stretch of the imagination. So they weren't incorrect with that. And so I went off on this tirade. I said, you're right. I don't pull wire very well, but I used to jump out of windows for a living, and I'm still here to talk about it. So if I could jump out of windows and live, surely you can stand on top of a ladder and follow some advice of a guy who used to fall for a living. And it kind of blew their mind. Anyway, as I was going off on this rant, one of the executives heard it and then asked me to speak up in the safety meeting, and it got everybody's attention, and I end up having this very diverse group of tradespeople, over 100 strong, listening to every word over a 10-minute toolbox talk. And another executive came to me and asked if I would present it as a keynote presentation at one of their annual stand downs. And I said, absolutely.
Cool.
And I had no idea what a keynote was. So I quickly went back, Googled what keynote speakers were. And when I realized that this was a career that you could have, where I could get paid to speak, I'm like, that's acting only with my own words. That's the dream.
Right.
So that that became the career. And then that has pivoted to a whole bunch of people coming up to me and saying, how do you do what you do? Like, you're so good at it. And it's always nice to have the stroke of the ego, but I'm, you know, blessed with upbringing and genetics that has allowed me to do this thing comfortably.
Yeah.
And to have a diverse set of 35 years of experience that has led me to this. So what I've started to do is teach people, because it's actually not difficult. A lot of, you know, it's the number two fear behind the fear of falling, and above the fear of death is the fear of public speaking. So most people will express anxiety around it, and yet it's really actually not that difficult to do when you understand why you're anxious around public speaking.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what is it that gets people anxious? Is it the fear of embarrassment, the fear of people judging them and or not knowing what to say, or yeah, I mean, that's what I guess what it would be, so, right?
No, but it's exactly that. So most people think they have this fear of public speaking, which they don't. It's what you just said. It's that fear of judgment that gets over it. And so all the rest of that, all the rest of what you had mentioned ties into that fear mm-hmm. of judgment, right? Fear of the unknown, fear of forgetting what you're talking about. All of those come back to how will I be perceived and am I going to be judged for the things that I'm saying or for my inability to say them? And once you can overcome that fear of judgment by recognizing that the audience is actually on your side, right? Nobody shows up to a thing to be disappointed.
Yeah.
That's not human nature. I've never shown up to a talk and thought to myself, man, I hope this sucks and the guy doesn't know what he's talking about, or that this woman is blanks and becomes nervous and serves no value to me. That is not a mindset that any audience goes to. Even if you go to a movie and you've read every Rotten Tomatoes review on it, and that movie is scoring 5 on Rotten Tomatoes with an audience score of 0.
Right.
You go into the theater and you go, it can't be that bad, could it?
Yeah.
Or if this is that bad, maybe it's that bad kind of good. We all go in expecting the best. So the audience is on your side. You don't have to worry about that. And then what I teach is ways to, most people get nervous because they're afraid they're going to forget what they're going to say. And that fear comes from this mentality that we need to memorize a script of a speech. And as soon as you free yourself from the burden of memorizing a script, which is, by the way, an extreme burden and a waste of rehearsal time and practice time and mental space for somebody, when you can free yourself from that burden, the fear of judgment just dissolves away, because now you are taking your authority back. You already know the audience is on your side, and now you start to tell your story and your understanding of something on a structured manner. I'm not saying to get rid of structure. What I'm saying is to get rid of memorizing a script word for word for word.
Mm-hmm.
We still need to have structure. So now we start focusing on what is the structure? What is the journey I need to take the audience on? What are the key deliverables that I have to give them and provide them so that I make sure that they walk away with at least one thing? And then if I can give them that, now I have done my job, and now you've taken the power back, and that fear of public speaking, which is we've now realized is actually a fear of public judgment, that judgment dissolves because you know you are the authority and you know that the audience is on your side, so they're judging you in a positive way and you just feed off that energy.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's great, right? And I think you summed up very well, like, exactly, you know, how it works. And, you know, what's interesting to me is, like, how when you listen to someone speak, whether it's in the context of a speech or a lecture or stand-up or, you know, and, like, any kind of show, what the feeling that you want, at least what I want, is that you want it to feel like what they're saying is not scripted, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can sometimes feel when it's scripted, and then there's an art form to those, you know, performers or speakers who have learned how to learn their script so well that it doesn't sound scripted, and that's good, but it's also restrictive, right? In the sense of like, yeah, it's restrictive in the sense of like, well, you're not speaking freely. So there's still that element of like too scripted, right? So how does that like come into play there?
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the comedy, because that, hands down, and I've been in and around a lot of different types of performance, stand-up comedy is the absolute hardest performance medium on the planet. And I will argue with anyone over that, because not only there's an expected outcome with comedy. Mm-hmm. You go to a play or a movie or whatever, you don't know how you're supposed to feel. Maybe you laugh, maybe you cry. Even if you go to a comedic play or show, you're not expected to laugh the whole time. Like, you know you're going to laugh. There's probably going to be a few, but you're not, you know, entertain me, monkey.
Yeah.
And where with a comedy show, you're expected that, you know that you're going and you're going to hear jokes. And so you know that if the thing that they say doesn't make you laugh, they're not actually doing what they said they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates such a cumbersome and awkward performance style that most comedians are the ones that are good are just so gifted to get over. But look at how good comedy comes through. They all tell stories.
Yeah.
And that's how you get away from that scripted line. So they're recalling moments. They're really good comedy comes from either observation or storytelling. And observation is just a different form of storytelling. You're telling a story of something that you've seen versus a story of something that's happened to you. But you look at the great, great, great comedians, from Amy Schumer to, even Jerry Seinfeld, right? The way that they go through and explain the world as they see them, they're just explaining the world through their eyes, but they're doing it through story. So what they know is they know a series of stories that they're going to tell, and they've crafted where the punchlines go. So there's a little bit of memorization to it, but you can see good comics because they're still just telling a story. And like, for me, I'm Canadian, so Russell Peters is like,
yeah,
one of my all-time favorite comedians right now. And I've probably been to a good 30 of his shows and watched every one of his Netflix specials.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to the shows before the Netflix specials come out, so I've seen him tape some of this stuff.
Yeah.
The punchlines are all the same. The jokes, we know the jokes, right? Oh, somebody's going to get hurt real bad. Yeah. Like, we know how it goes, but each time he tells it, it's just slightly different. Slightly different, because he's in the moment and he's working with the crowd. And that's where you got the really good comedians. They feed off the energy of the crowd. They know where they are. They know when they can drop a joke from their set. They also have a repertoire of other ones. So if this one is working and this theme is working, they can pull from that. And so what we can all learn from the great comedians is that story and the power of story and knowing your story is what's important. Les Brown, who is a phenomenal, phenomenal speaker, has always said, never tell a story without a point and never make a point without a story.
Mm.
So you want to make sure that you're incorporating these stories, because that is how you illustrate your point, and it's also easier for you to remember. It's hard to remember a memorized script that you wrote 2 days ago, but it's really easy to remember an impactful event that is seared into your memory from even 20 or 30 years ago. And that's why story is so effective.
Yeah. And it's always fun to see it in comedy if you're a comedy fan, right? Because not everyone is, but I mean, it's weird because I'm like, how can you not be a fan of comedy? But I mean, that's just my opinion on it. It's about storytelling. And just as a side point, like, I just thought that there are interesting like comedians who tell like proper jokes. You know, like Jimmy Carr or like Anthony Jeselnik, where their jokes are structured with like premise, twist, and punchline, and they just tell like 100 of them, right? And that's much more like memorized and scripted, but it still works. And it's what's interesting about those shows is that like, well, what you'll remember is you remember one or two or three of them that sort of like really hit you. Right. And then whereas if you watch a different kind of comedian that's a storyteller, it's much more easy to remember the stories and because you get like emotionally invested in them, even if it's somewhat, you know, fabricated or embellished or whatever it is to like really bring out the humor of it. That's the skill of the comedian. It's like that's where you attach your memory and your identification with it, because you're like, oh, I've seen that too, or that's happened to me, or I know that someone that's happened to, or it really like brings it into perspective. And what's, you know, what I also was thinking about it on this line is that, like, well, if you look at, I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent on it, but if you look at how humans have relayed knowledge and wisdom over time, it's through stories, right?
Yes.
Like the all sacred texts and biblical texts, whether it's like the Bible or the Bhagavad Gita or, you know, whatever it is, they're stories, and or they're anecdotes at least, and teaching stories, because it's like, well, that's how people know and remember and learn shit, is it's through the mm-hmm. stories. And I mean, it's very interesting. And so it makes perfect sense why, you know, what's important if you're communicating with someone, at least in like a, let's say, a professional sense, is it's like, well, you want to be telling stories, because that's what grabs people's attention. That's what makes it memorable. It's what helps people identify with what's happening, right? And then there's that, the cliche of the moral of the story. I mean, everyone yes. knows that, right? And that's what it's about, right?
Yeah, if you treat everything like an afternoon special or an episode of Full House, right? Like, imagine at the end of your story, there's going to be a little bit of a music swell, and even Scooby-Doo. And what we've learned today, kids, is it's exactly that. And I'm so happy that you brought up how our oral history has worked. Because what I think a lot of people forget about is it's real easy in today's lens to dismiss the power of story because everybody can read. And so we read news articles and we read blogs and whatever. There's a proliferation of written word and a large portion of the population who can understand that text. But 300-400 years ago, that was not the case. Literacy is a relatively new thing to human society. And yet for thousands of years, we have maintained our history. Some of it from learned men and women who understood how to document the histories through text. But the retelling of those stories and the fact that we know to go and look for those comes strictly from an oral tradition. I mean, you look at Plato and the great Greek philosophers. People came to an auditorium. The word comes from the breakdown of the Latin audio, right? Mm-hmm. It's a space to hear noise.
Yeah.
And we spoke an oral tradition for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And that's yeah. how we have learned. And the reason for that is it allows me to see the world through your eyes. It's how you can communicate to me your perception of the world. And it allows me to walk because you are filling in the detail of the story. And now I get to see the things that were important to you and why those things matter. And in the comic sense, that's why the setup is so important, because you need to understand the absurdity or their viewpoint so that you get the punchline. And so all of that context in the story becomes very succinct. And I would argue that even if you look at a comedian like Jimmy Carr, who does traditional setup punchline,
yeah.
you know, setup twist punchline, although those jokes are rapid fire, they're still mini stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you have to understand, you know, three blondes walked into a bar. The third one should have ducked.
Yeah.
It's still a setup. Like, the narrative is still there, even in a very quick one-liner throwaway joke.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good point, is that they're still mini stories. They're not as in-depth as, you know, a 5 or a 7 minute story, because you're not getting all the details, but it's still, they're recalling an event that at least hypothetically happened, you know, about people acting in a certain way or doing something, or something happened and here's the funny bit. right? Or here's why they shouldn't have, or whatever it is. And I mean, that's what makes them good, is that they know how to frame those jokes and put them out really well. But it is, they're just mini stories of this happened, right? It's not like, yeah, I guess, you know, there'd be no humor if the joke was like, oh, you know, some people are dumb. And then you're like, okay, I mean, that's not a joke. You know, you need to be describing why they're dumb. You have to walk people through the experience and get that explanation out to really find that part of it. But yeah. It is interesting, right? And storytelling is fundamental just everywhere. I mean, you see it in music, right? Songs, poetry, those are stories. I mean, the way they're told is slightly different, sure. But that's the beauty of, like, you know, literary narratives and things like that. And the greatest, like, literary people in history, they're all just telling stories. Like Shakespeare is, I guess, one of the most famous ones. And he's famous because he tells stories. Like, that's what he's known for. And it's taught to basically every student who learns at least English in the modern world. I don't know about in...
Well, and the Bard's been translated into, you know, dozens of languages and is recognized throughout the world. I mean, I've seen a performance of Romeo and Juliet in Japan. So the... And in Japanese, and great staging, by the way. It's actually one of my highlight versions, because, again, I've grown up in theater, and I think the first time I staged Romeo and Juliet was a junior high school performance in grade 8. But that Japanese version was just so heart-wrenchingly beautiful. They really did a good job of it, and you know, adapted it to not necessarily the text or the story, but conceptualized it within modern day Japan and two warring factions of different crime syndicates. So it was actually quite an interesting retelling of the story.
Actually, that's true, right? That's true. It actually has nothing to do with language, right? They're archetypal human experiences that are being portrayed or communicated in various ways at different points in time to have the most meaning to the people of that time, I suppose, right? So when you see it adapted to a modern version of a particular culture, the impact is even greater sometimes. You don't even have to understand what's happening.
I was lucky because if I didn't know the play intimately from having performed it a couple of dozen times.
Yeah.
Like, there's two Shakespeare plays that I can just go and watch without blinking. Richard III and Romeo and Juliet. Mm. Like, I just, because I know the lines in and out. So it doesn't matter what language I see it. It's already translated in my head. But it goes back to the study that Joseph Campbell did on the hero's journey. I mean, all great stories follow this same pattern of that, you know, obviously Joseph Campbell explored it better than I could explain, but the situation of, you have characters who are in a, you know, static state where they're unaware, and then all of a sudden an event, a triggering event happens that throws them into a state of chaos, and then they are introduced to a mentor who comes and takes them through a series of trials and tribulations that get them prepared for the final battle or overcoming their nemesis. And then once that happens, then they have the journey home. And you look at all great literary works, even just modern day blockbusters, all the Star Wars films follow that same narrative. All of Tolkien's works follow the same narrative, from The Hobbit to Lord of the Rings, and then his really boring stuff like The Silmarillion does not.
Yeah.
Because The Silmarillion just reads like a Bible. So that's why, you know, the stories that really work, the ones that have the most impact, follow the same structure of the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. And it's because that is what resonates most with storytelling. That's where really impactful story comes from. And again, I would tie it back to the comedic timing. A really good comedic stories still follow the hero's journey. They just do it with a lens of finding the humor versus finding the tragedy.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. And you can look at the greats of today and you do see that, oh, this archetypal story narrative is the same. I mean, I think I read, I can't remember what the book was called, but it was something about how there's like 7 main narratives for stories. Right?
Yeah.
And the hero's journey is like the main one. And it's interesting why people are so attracted to it. And I guess it's because it somewhat incorporates or represents how we view ourselves typically in terms of our journey through life. And, you know, you get thrown all these really difficult challenges and things that come out of nowhere, and you know, you have to really step up your game to confront these great challenges of life. And I mean, they're not always as adventurous and dramatic as is often portrayed in the stories, but that's the fun part of the stories, is that you get to, you know, live through those experiences and be inspired to be the hero of your own story, right?
Well, and in retelling stories too, so yes, you get to relive it. But one of the things that I typically teach in my workshops is that if you want to have an impactful story for your audience, where most people get retelling their stories wrong when it comes to being on stage and putting on and having an impactful presentation, is that when you tell your story, you're not actually the hero of the story. When you tell a story and you are the hero, it becomes very egocentric and your audience tends to tune you out.
Hmm.
But if you tell the story and make your audience the hero, what it does is it makes you the sage, the mentor at that third step in the hero's journey. And now you are guiding your audience through trials and tribulations based on your experience. So in the Star Wars analogy, you tell the story like you are Obi-Wan Kenobi speaking of the Clone Wars versus I'm Luke Skywalker and I went on this great adventure to become a Jedi.
Mm.
You're already the Jedi. You're just training a Padawan and bringing them through under mentorship and guidance. And when you change your story around to that light, you know, this is what I went through so that you can do this. Who here has struggled with this scenario that I was dealing with 4, 5, 10 years ago? This is what brought me into a state of awareness about this. Are you even aware of this? Let's walk you through. These are the things that I did. You can do them too. And when you do that, your audience becomes really involved, really engaged. And that's how you effectively tell those stories from stage, is by changing your perspective.
Mm.
And telling it from the sage perspective versus the hero's perspective. And that creates your audience as the hero, and you just want to guide them so that they can overcome that final trial or battle with their nemesis, whatever that nemesis happens to be.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's brilliant, right? Because otherwise you're just being like, I'm awesome. This is all the cool shit that I did.
Exactly.
Here, you know, cheer me on. Like, and that's not... Yeah. People are going to be like, oh, okay, yeah, good for you, well done, or whatever. But it's not the same kind of impact as if you're bringing them into your world and being like, yeah, you can do it too, you know? Like, I'll show you, or not even I'll show you, but it's like, here are the lessons that I've learned. Now you do you, right? Like, I mean, it's really engaging the audience at that level of them being the hero. And I guess that appeals to our inner desire to be the hero, right, of our own stories, and not just see heroic people in the world. While that is inspiring, it's not the best way. I guess also you see it in like autobiographies, right, where a good autobiography doesn't tell the story just as the story. It tells it in a way that you can be a part of the story.
Yeah.
And you can really go on the journey with them, so to speak, and live through it and then get something back for yourself at the end of it. You're not just hearing the narrative of some person's, you know, life history or something like that. So do people come to you for like autobiography stuff?
Yeah. So not necessarily to help create their autobiography. But what we do with all of the training that we do, either with the Power to Speak Naked or Power of Influence or any of our other events that that I put on, we break down, you know, because what ends up happening, and I already know it, I know that there's somebody who's listening to Underground Annex right now, and they're saying, well, yeah, but my life isn't interesting. You know, my life is boring. And to that, I would say, your life doesn't have to be a theatrical blockbuster,
mm-hmm.
right? We don't need to have the explosions. We don't need to have lived through a James Bond film in order to have teachable moments within our life. So what we do is I have a really quick process where we take people's lives and we divide it into 5 epochs. And it's really, really, really simple. You just literally take your age and divide it by 5 and then use like third grade math with remainders. Remember you divided to the whole and then you had a remainder?
Yeah.
Well, we take that remainder, we tack it on to the beginning, that first time period, and that becomes the first time period, and then you move on, because the highest remainder that you're going to have is 4,
mm-hmm.
right? If we're dividing evenly by 5, the biggest remainder that you should have is 4, and nobody remembers anything half the time for their first or second age anyway. So, like, for me, I guess the highest remainder you'd have, it would change. So this is why I'm not a good mathematician and why I'm good at language arts and not so good at math. But for me, I'm 42, I'll be 42 at the end of the month. And so I would divide by 5, that gives me even time periods of 8 and then a mm-hmm. remainder of 2. And so I just take that, tack it on at the beginning, and that, so my first time period is 0 to 10. So anybody can do this. And then ask yourself, what is the most memorable thing that happened in each one of those time periods? Doesn't have to be tragic, doesn't have to be happy, it could be neutral, it could be whatever, but everybody has at least 5 memories in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that you can't not. So what is the most memorable thing that happened in that first time period, and then the second time period, the third, fourth, and fifth, and write it down. For me, the most memorable thing that happened in that first time period, both of them, I have 2 really significant memories, and both of them happened when I was 6 years old. The first one would have been mid-December and being in the first play that I was ever in, which was just a high school auditorium Christmas play. And yeah. I got to play Joseph.
Nice.
And it was the first time that I ever heard an audience laugh and applaud. For me, for something that I had done. And that became just this addictive high that I've chased now for 36 years. But the next memorable event was the sound that my mother made February 10th, 1986, when the RCMP, our police detachment, and my family physician came to the door and told my mom that my father had passed away in a motor vehicle accident. She made the most terrifying sound I've ever heard in my entire life, and I hope I never hear it again. And I was in a totally separate room away from the door of our house, and it sent chills. You know when, like, just, if you've ever seen a movie where there's an epicenter of an event and an energy wave blasts out.
Shockwaves.
All of, you know, and it just goes everywhere and you see the energy. That happened when my mom made that noise. It penetrated through the neighborhood. I'm sure everyone in the neighborhood heard it. And I think of it as The Princess Bride, when they torture Wesley and he makes the sound of ultimate suffering. And it resonated through the forest and in throughout the kingdom, and everybody was put off by it. That was the sound that my mom made. And so those are the 2 most significant memories that happened in that first time period for me. And I can do that for every one of the time periods. And then the real key to that is, again, going back to what Les Brown said, never tell a story without a point. Never make a point without a story. You then have to analyze those stories and say, why does that stand out in my mind? Why is that such a significant event that however many years later, you know, if you're 20, that first time period is only 15 years removed. If you're me, now we're getting 35 years removed. If you're somebody who's in your 80s, that first time period may be, you know, 70 years ago.
Yeah.
But it still stands out. So why? Why was it significant? What was the reason that it resonated with you? And then what are the lessons that could be taught from there? And there are multiple.
Mm. Depends on your angle.
There are so many different ways. Like for me, I can teach the joys of hearing applause, but I can also talk about the negative consequences of needing constant approval from other people to feel significant. So there are so many different lessons that I can teach in that event. There are so many lessons that I can teach from listening to my mom, the motivation to make sure that she never hears that again, understanding the struggle and sacrifice that goes into parenting, knowing how to present information to somebody in a way that doesn't completely and totally devastate their world, even though what you're about to tell them could devastate their world.
Right.
There are ways of doing that. So there are multiple lessons that can be taught, and it's just a matter of finding what those are and then structuring those talks for your audience so that it's framed in a way that they get the message. A comedian is going to turn around and tell it the one way so that they find the humor in it.
Yeah.
You, as if you want to be a motivational speaker, you might want to find the inspiration in it. And if you want to use it as a warning device, then you want to find the tragedy in it so that people can learn, can see the warning.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things. And I can do that with each one of those stories. I could tell them all 1,000 different ways and find the grace in each one.
Yeah. No, it's so true. And I think, excuse me, I think what it highlights is that, you know, the shared human experience is something very interesting because we all go through similar trials and tribulations, you know, using that narrative, of varying kinds, but there's so many moments or feelings particularly of whatever, of both joy and tragedy and inspiration and fear and sadness and all that kind of stuff that exists in different variations of the same theme. So, you know, everyone, let's say, will have experienced tragedy in their lives, but the actual story of it looks different, but you can use your version of it to communicate that to someone if that's what you're trying to tell, right? And so I think it's very interesting how you approach it, where you can take any story that has meaning to you, and it will if you remember it after so many years, that you can take it and spin it, so to speak, in different directions depending on what you're trying to achieve with it, right? Yeah, and just going to like varying depths of all of it. I mean, you know, like that story with your mom, I mean, you could probably spend an hour talking about just that.
Yeah.
Now, maybe you'd have to do some prep work, but you could do it, right?
No, yeah, and that's the thing. It's such an impactful point of my life that I actually don't need prep work. Mm. I can stretch that story out to a day if I needed to, because I could literally just relive the hours and the hours and the hours. Wouldn't maybe be as exciting as a retelling of it within a 45-minute to an hour mm-hmm. time period, but I could definitely take an hour and discuss that story. Just the same way that I can present it in 30 seconds to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Because I lived it. And that's the power of story. You don't forget it. And then how you frame those stories is up to you, as you said, how you need to deliver it. I think Mark Twain said it famously, humor is tragedy plus time.
Mm-hmm.
So especially with these very significant events for you, you can pick out, you can tell the narrative however you need to tell it. Just by putting on the lens when you're crafting that story of knowing what is the outcome, what emotion am I trying to elicit, what change am I trying to affect by telling this story, which again is why never tell a story without a point, but never make a point without a story. You need to know what the point is.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can do that, then you can put the lens of crafting that story and you can tell it. And because it's your story, because you know what it is, you can stretch that out from 30 seconds to 30 hours if you needed to. It's
right.
entirely up to you how and why you tell that story.
Yeah, and if you're just, you know, somewhat confident that you can continue speaking, then you don't need that script on it. I mean, it helps, and obviously revisions and things like that make a difference, and you know, you get feedback from audiences what they like, because I suppose it doesn't always match up how you think it's going to go. But that's the skill and the art of you know, repeating the same story different ways and whatever it is. But you know, another interesting aspect of it is that I'm always fascinated. So I've never like performed live in front of people before, not because I don't know. It just never sparked my interest much. I mean, I've had some fantasy of like doing stand-up, but I suppose that's more just because it looks awesome. Just like, you know, when you see someone doing something expertly, you're like, that's fucking cool. I want to do that. Mm-hmm. I do the same thing with like professional athletes and speakers. I'm like, there's something about it that just entices you. But it doesn't mean that I'm like a comedian or anything like that, right? But anyway, so what's interesting is how performance is cathartic for people, right? And how a lot of the time, you know, I've heard on like podcasts and stuff like that, I've heard comedians or just performers of any, or musicians even, performers of any type, explain how through the process of performing, particularly with like stand up and things like that, because you get to tell whatever you want, right? You're not acting in a character as such. I mean, maybe there's a persona involved or something, but that's besides the point. But it's like you get to still write your own stuff, and so you get to process these stories and these emotions in a way that, you know, works for you and your craft, but that there's still some element of like going through it and processing it and feeling that like catharsis of telling your story, because, you know, we often don't get to tell our stories to people just because most things in the world that are discussed are like, if like, you know, news, politics, events, sport, that kind of thing. But once you dive in deep and you get to do that, then you really get to have that process. Has that been your experience as well?
No, and yeah, it's actually one of the lessons that we go through, and that is, and I'll say it to anyone, and it's one of the first things that we kind of work on, because most people need to get over the fear of judgment. And so the first thing we discuss is that the thing you're afraid to say is probably what your audience needs to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding that your audience is different from somebody else's audience, so, and your audience, Shane, and my audience, although may have similar traits, your audience is your audience. People are tuning into Underground Antics to listen to what you bring.
Mm-hmm.
They're not tuning in because you have Tyler Foley on the show today. My audience will be introduced to you because I will say, hey, I was on Underground Antics today. You should go check out that podcast. But the way that I present information, the way that you present information, although very similar, are still different. We resonate with our audiences differently.
Yeah.
And it's usually from that being vulnerable enough to share our information from a personal perspective. And so the first thing that I tackle with just about any one of my clients, and in fact all of my clients, because the ones who aren't willing to tackle it don't maintain a relationship with me, because it's just, we can't go forward.
Yeah.
Is that the thing that you're afraid to say is what your audience needs to hear. That's how you find them. That's how you find people who are going to resonate with your messaging, by saying the thing that was tough and coming out and being vulnerable enough to tell the truth about how you felt in a situation. And that's where we find, you know, whatever you want to call them, your audience, your tribe, your group, your community. They're all the same words. They are like-minded individuals. And those are the people who are going to resonate with the message that you have, because they're the ones who need to hear it the most.
Mm-hmm.
So getting real, getting raw, it's why my book is called The Power to Speak Naked, because we want to expose ourselves to the naked truth to be able to say it effectively and without gimmicks.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where you really have the most power to affect change. So yeah, no, getting out, getting in front, saying the thing that you're afraid to say, that's usually where you're going to find your messaging the most. And you'll stumble, right? Yeah. You won't always deliver it the right way or the way that you thought. Or as you'd mentioned, sometimes you say a thing and it doesn't have the impact that you thought. Part of that could be through the way that you've told the story, and part of that could be the audience that's receiving it.
Sure.
Right? If I'm broadcasting an FM radio and I want my message to get out, I'm on talk radio and I put it out, the only people who are going to hear that message are the people who are tuned into the broadcast frequency that I'm on.
Yeah.
We have to be on the same frequency, and if we're not on the same frequency, my message isn't going to resonate. And I think a lot of people forget that not everybody is ideal for your message.
Yeah, of course.
And the more specific you can get with your messaging, right? Like, people have to tune in. They have to get to 107.3 or whatever it is on the dial.
Yeah.
But the people who actively tune into that, those are the ones that come back more over and over and over again. Those are the people you want to speak to. Quit trying to get the pop rock people if you're a country station. It just isn't going to happen.
Yeah. It doesn't help either, because it's not any... I mean, no one wins, right? Like, it's a weird format. Like, when I started the podcast, like, I had this idea in my head where I was like, okay, I know that most people aren't going to probably want to listen, and that's okay, because I'm not trying to, you know, have the whole world listen to what I have to say. Like, that's not how it goes. But I got to figure out how to find that 1 in 100 or that 1 in 1,000 who is like into it, right? Who tunes into that frequency, and then just build that up slowly, right? Which has been working relatively well so far. But it is interesting to sort of take the approach of like, you know, even like with friends and family and stuff like that, I'm like, hey, if you don't want to listen, don't listen. Like, that's fine. Like, it's not, I'm not, you know, making everyone listen, or if they don't, I don't feel offended or feel bad about it, because I'm like, no, well, like, what am I supposed to say? Like, you know, I like some stuff, you like some stuff, like, that's just how it goes. But it is an interesting way of like approaching it, right? Where, no, I'm not saying my way, I'm saying the way that you're proposing, where it's like you got to like have a frequency to tune into, right? And I suppose another way that it's commonly phrased is like finding your voice, which is like finding that thing that speaks. Yeah. What were you going to say?
So yes and no. So finding your voice, I think, is important in delivering your message effectively.
Okay. Right?
And what finding your voice means is just really finding the courage to speak authentically. And by the way, I hate the word authentic right now. I find it overused and frankly, misunderstood.
Yeah.
I would say that authenticity is synonymous with self-awareness. So what it is people finding the self-awareness within themselves to have the courage to speak the thing that they're afraid to say. And that, when people talk about having found their voice, that's usually what it is. That at that point, they're not afraid to say the thing. You know, zero cares are given in the delivery of this message, because I don't care who it's not for. My message is for the people that it is for. But what you got to remember is that you're not speaking for you.
Mm.
You're speaking for your audience. And you need to keep... If you're speaking from a point of ego because you want people to think you're great, you probably aren't going to succeed. You're going to hit your head against the wall more times than not. Or if you do succeed, it will be very fleeting success, because people will see through it quickly. Where if you are speaking with the intent and purpose of serving an audience, the message will resonate. You will find your audience. You may have to struggle along a little bit, but I mean, even, you know, you look at your podcast, you're, you know, over 20 episodes now. You've got a decent social following. You're getting 2,000 downloads regularly. Like, that's an accomplishment. There's a lot of other podcasts who would look to you and go, How'd you do it, Shane? Like, what's the secret sauce? And you may be looking at some of those other larger podcasts going, well, you know, they've got 100,000 downloads an episode and a social following of 2, 3, 4 million. How do they do that? And I think one of the key things, if you want to do what I do for a living, is there needs to be constant growth.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do that is to always be mentored by somebody 2, 3, 4 steps ahead of you. Have a very dedicated peer group of people who are at or around your same level, and then be teaching the people who are looking up to you going, how did you do that? And you need to have all three, right? The Trinity is found in all things in life. And I think people, when they find they don't have work-life balance, or when they find that they are lacking or missing or any of that, it's because they haven't found that Trinity. And from a professional standpoint, that Trinity is mentorship, peer support, and passing on your knowledge. So that you have, you know, you are a mentor and a tutor here, you are a peer that is here, and you are a student from this level. And when you have all three combined, that's when you are going to find the most joy and significance out of your life, because you are growing, you are being supported in your growth, and you are helping other people grow. And that is I can't even begin to describe that feeling, and I'm somebody who uses words for a living.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right with that, where it really positions you in a place that's maximally effective for growth and for benefit for everyone, right? And it's an interesting system because it's so powerful in that, you know, you in the one sense, you're like, okay, well, it keeps your ego in check. You're like, I'm not the best. Even if you don't want to be the best, it's good to know that you're not. So you have mentors who have, you know, done, I mean, it's hard to say, but it's like who at least more successful in the area that you're trying to be successful in or something like that, right? Like maybe they're shitty people too, or they obviously have mistakes and struggles, and it's not like they're gods or whatever it is, but it's like, yeah, okay, so there's room to improve, right? Then you have the network of peers who are at your level, so you're like, okay, I'm one of the people, right? So there's other people like me, you know, not super special, nothing like that, but you feed off each other, you get to learn from each other's experiences, going through similar trials at similar times, right? Like, because someone who did it 10 years ago might not face the same challenges you're facing now, but your peers are, because they're doing it now as well. And then there's that teaching element mentoring element, where there's other people coming up and trying to do the same sort of thing, and you're like, well, I've learned some stuff. If you want to know, like, I can tell you what I've learned. I mean, I don't know if it will work for you, but you can at least see and hear what worked for me, right, in that sense. And it's really weird because, like, that's the part that's like very fulfilling, is that teaching part of it, right? Like, even when people ask me questions that I don't have answers to, about, like, you know, how I've gotten to where I'm at or whatever it is, which is not even that, you know, that big, but it's just a nice sort of step. It's like, honestly, a lot of the time I'm like, I don't even really know. I don't even know the answer to that. I can be like, I'll tell you what I did, and I don't know exactly which part of it worked or why it worked, but that's just sort of what I can offer. And even that, knowing that, you know, it's not necessarily like a step-by-step guide for people, it's a really good feeling to be able to just offer someone something of value, right, when they're trying to do something and or be, you know, sort of make something of them, of something. I mean, I use something a lot there, but yeah.
Well, and that's the key too. So you really honed in on it, that it doesn't have to be everything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to give people the complete roadmap.
Yeah.
Sometimes all you have to do is give them a little bit of fuel for their gas tank.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to get you to your final destination, but I should be able to at least get you to the next fuel station.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of always been my philosophy. I mean, I'm a constant learner. I'm definitely a student of performance and stage, but I'm still, like, I still get coaching. I've been acting for 35 years. I just auditioned on Sunday and hired a coach to help me through with the audition. Not because I don't know how to audition. It's not even because I don't know how to act.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got over, I don't know, with 25 credits on IMDb, I think. Something like that.
Congratulations.
But thank you. But I can always use help. You know, there's people who obviously work way more than me. I mean, I guarantee you there is nobody listening in your audience right now unless they've come to you from my side of the fence. Yeah. That was like, Tyler Foley, oh yeah, that actor who was in Freddy vs. Jason. Yeah, yeah, I know him. Nobody said that. Right. No one. Nobody knows who I am. So there are people who I can learn from in that craft. There, when it comes to my speaking, there are people who I'm constantly working with. I'm in a great mastermind group that has some really phenomenal speakers. I get to sit down with Les Brown every month.
Wow.
You know, and that's, yeah, that's cool, right? And I get to work with people, you know, who speak internationally all the time, where I'm just starting to do that now. And it's because they're passing their knowledge on to me. And then within my peer group, I'm going, okay, well, what's working for you? What's working for you? How are you getting your message out? Is that working? And then we have the support there. And then I have the people whose seminars are coming to me. But I'm doing it with the idea, when I'm training somebody, I'm speaking to me 5-10 years ago. You know what? These are the struggles that I had. This is how you can get to where I am now. But I'm still striving for here. I want you to get to here too, which means at some point you're going to, I'm going to stop. I'm still going to be Obi-Wan Kenobi, but I need to get you now to Yoda.
Yeah.
Yoda will finish your training. It wasn't that Obi-Wan wasn't a good Jedi and to himself. It's just Yoda has eons more knowledge. And that is always my goal. I need to get people up to a point where I can pass them on to the next group of mentorship for them. So most of my training relationships don't last more than 6 months to a year.
Right.
And those year ones, when they want to stick around, I'm like, great, you are now a peer. I've given you everything that I know. You're a peer. Welcome to my social circle.
Welcome to the club.
To the people that I'm learning from, and maybe you will find some value from them.
That's great, because I think that also will, you know, help people just to see that it's always a process of growth and learning, right? And then you're not going about proposing that, you know, I'm the best, I know everything, I'll get you to the stars. You're like, nope, I'm just one step in the road, right? Like, I'll help you get to this step and maybe show you the direction to the next one or something like that, right? And that's great, because that's also more empowering for people to know that it's like you're just empowering them to do their own thing, and then ultimately they're going to do the same, hopefully, for other people, right? And that it's just this continuous, like, output of support and positivity and growth that fosters these great communities and that everyone just about benefits from in different ways. And, you know, there's all these different relationships that form that are really cool and interesting and fun, and you get to learn and grow from each other. And that's really, I mean, just what the human experience is, right? Especially if you're like in a growth aspect, not just a social aspect. But yeah, I mean, listen, man, that's really awesome. And I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been a lot of fun. So thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
It's my joy and pleasure, Shane.
Is there anything you'd like to plug or promote? I'll obviously also put the stuff in the description, but just so people can hear it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if anybody wants to, they can always visit my website, and I'll tell them how to find that first. But before I do, I just want to remind them that if they are getting value out of what you're doing, Shane, and if Underground Antics is serving them in any way, especially somebody who is starting to grow their following, I'm sure you could use some 5-star reviews. Am I correct in assuming that?
Sure. I mean, they always help, right?
Exactly. So if you're listening to this right now, if you could do me a favor As somebody who is regularly a guest on podcasts, I know good hosts. I know good shows, and Shane is an incredible host and has a great show going on. So if you are listening to this and you found value with this episode or some of the other episodes that have been released, and you're coming back regularly and you're listening, if you could take a moment and just hit pause and give it a 5-star review, because that's how other people will find this show. It will help Shane do more with what he's doing. It'll help him get even bigger and better guests on, because trust me, we look and we judge. So if you want bigger and better guests for Shane to be able to do it, having more 5-star reviews will absolutely help him in booking better and bigger guests to serve you, the listener. So it only benefits you, the listener. So hit pause on whatever device you're listening to this on right now. Whatever platform you're on, go give it the 5-star review or the thumbs up or whatever it needs so that you can boost its social verification. And then when you're done that, now that you're back, because you did, you hit pause. I know you did. You hit pause and you,
welcome
and
back.
You gave it a 5-star review. Anybody who wants to, welcome back. You can find me at SeanTylerFoley.com. It's SeanTylerFoley.com. And that has all my socials. So you, if you're Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, they're all there. And I have a free gift for any of your listeners, Shane, who go there right now. Right on the front landing page, we have the method. If they click on that, it's a free download, 5 insider secrets that I've put together over 35 years of public speaking. It's a very easy to read 11-page document with instantly actionable items that they can use right now to be more confident in their speaking.
Amazing. Thank you very much. And I appreciate those words that you said and, you know, calling out for that support. It means a lot. And yeah, man, I look forward to speaking with you again. Hopefully you'll come on sometime again in the future. We can continue talking about all the fun stuff of the world.
And it'll be my joy and pleasure, Shane. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, brother. We'll speak soon. Take care.